Astonishing Legends Network.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts and listeners on the Astonishing Dead Letter Office are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Astonishing Legends Productions, the Astonishing Legends Network, or any affiliated entities or guests.
When something unexplainable happens to you, it can make you feel isolated or alone. But trust us, you're not. For over a decade, you've been sending your strange stories to Astonishing Legends. And now it's time for our fellow Legenders to hear them too. Join us weekly in Blanket Fortiana as we dig through your intriguing messages to the Astonishing Dead Letter Office.
Tonight's episode, The Kids in the Parking Lot.
Tonight, we're going back to the summer of 1996, and we're getting off the highway in the dead middle of Pennsylvania, like almost a geographical center. And as a former part-time resident of Bucks County, which is on the eastern border of Pennsylvania, I can tell you, getting off the road in the middle of rural Pennsylvania is a bigger decision than most people think.
Why is that?
Well, it's just very remote. It's a spooky state, and it's a gorgeous state. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. It's amazing, but it's spooky.
Well, I guess a lot of people treat Pennsylvania as a drive-through state. I can't imagine why, but it does have a complicated personality.
Yeah.
There are a lot of amazing places between Philly and Pittsburgh, but there's also a lot of roads less traveled in the middle, shall we say.
Yes, and taking the road less traveled makes all the difference, unless you're trying to find food, fuel, and lodging in the middle of rural Pennsylvania.
Well, our listener tonight, John, at the time was a college kid out of New Jersey and was on his first big solo road trip to Gen Con, which is North America's largest tabletop gaming convention. Now, that sounds like a lot of fun. And that was founded by one of the co-creators of Dungeons & Dragons, Gary Gygax.
Yes, that's super cool. Yeah. I actually was at a party once in Hollywood when we lived out in L.A., and it was something my wife got invited to, and I got to go because that's how it always was. But the guy throwing the party actually owned one of Gary Gygax's sandals, and people were passing it around at the party. Yes, I actually held Gary Gygax's sandal.
Why? Well, isn't he missing a sandal? What did Gary have to say about this?
Well, he's no longer with us. So
I know, but what's the what's the story?
I don't remember
this?
The story. I do gather that it was either pretty expensive, or perhaps it was won in a game of D&D. I'm not sure.
Was there a vibe with it? I mean, it's like a relic. Like, what's the importance?
Yes, it was treated like a relic. Absolutely treated like a relic.
Okay.
Very good word for it.
All right.
The guy throwing the party, he only had one of them.
Okay.
And like I said, I don't fully remember its background story. Anyway, I'm pretty sure if you look it up on Instagram, if you look up Gary Gygax's sandal, a picture of him holding it comes up right away.
Okay, well.
Anyway, I digress. Let's get back to John's dead letter. Yes. So our listener John is on his way to Gen Con with his friends, and they're in the middle of Pennsylvania. And they're thinking, let's get off I-80 here and look for something to eat.
Yeah, well, there should be a lot of good eats along the road. And John is from Metuchen, New Jersey. And I just want to say, I just re-listened to me reading the story. It may have slipped out where I said Metuchen. Now, in my defense, if you know me at all closely, personally, through text, even in written form, I like to play around with the language.
Yes.
I like to manipulate how words sound. And that's why I feel a kinship with performers and creators like Matt Berry and Frank Black of the Pixies.
Yes. Well, oh, nice.
But even when I know it's the wrong thing or the incorrect thing, I'll often say
this is an elaborate excuse for mispronouncing Metuchen.
Because I remember way back when I said Moscow, Idaho, and I knew it was wrong. I'm from the area. I knew that was wrong, but I said it anyway. And then somebody kindly wrote in like, hey, you know, it's pronounced Moscow, like Costco.
Yeah.
And I go, I know that. I'm not sure why I said Moscow. But anyway, Jersey, well, like everywhere, you know, there's great rural places like the Pine Barrens, which we've talked about, home of our previously covered friend, of amalgamation here, the Jersey Devil. So when compared to that, Metuchen, it's fairly suburban and urban.
Well, let's talk about where John actually was in Pennsylvania on this road trip, because this stretch of road has a reputation. We're up along the I-80 corridor in north central Pennsylvania, Clinton County, give or take. Locals out there call it the I-80 frontier, and it's the front porch of what they now market as the Pennsylvania Wilds.
Wow.
Something like 60% of that county is state forest. It gets really dark out there at night, darker than most people expect.
Yeah, and it's old country comparatively for, well, every piece of land or dirt is old. But I mean, as far as people living on it, it's been settled, logged out, half emptied, then settled again for generations.
Yes. And the river that runs through Lock Haven, which is the area that this story takes place, is the west branch of the Susquehanna. And it's in a valley that native people from the region call Otsonoxin. The translation of that that got handed down is, wait for it, Demon's Den.
Of course.
Yeah. Maybe that's accurate. Maybe it's some 19th century writer dressing it up, which we've seen before over years of research. But either way, that's the name that stuck.
I want to go back to that story that I first heard in a Jim Harold campfire about a stretch of woods. I made a note of it in one of my many journals here where they saw eyes, like a group of red eyes in the branch of the woods, you know, where kids drive out there to go drink beers.
Yeah.
And
then
they were pelted with rocks running away. And somebody was being chased by something unseen, made it to the car, and something slammed into the car, and the dew on the windshield had a handprint on it. Great story, even if it was made up.
Yes.
Very good writing.
Yes.
But anyway, so this is all sounding like a very rich environment for an astonishing legend.
Indeed. And our two travelers don't know anything about all that.
Mm,
they're
that's right.
just tired. They want a meal and a room, and the night is getting long. What happens to them in the Demon's Den was so strange, it's now a dead letter. Forrest, whenever you're ready.
This tale occurred in 1996, as a friend of mine and I took on our first big solo road trip. We were both college-aged. Our plan was to go to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, to the Gen Con gaming convention from our home state of New Jersey. We set out in the late afternoon from his house in Metuchen and wound our way through Pennsylvania. Night fell, and we decided to begin looking for lodging. Being from suburban urban areas, we assumed the rest of the country was like central North New Jersey, and you could just pull off the parkway and find a hotel within a couple of minutes. I recall we were low, but not quite dangerously low on gas. We saw a sign for food, fuel, and lodging off the Pennsylvania Turnpike at an exit that was at or near Lock Haven, Pennsylvania. While I had been through the area on family trips, I wasn't familiar with what was off the highway, and I had never been that way on my own. I'm not sure if we took another road once we got off the exit or traveled right up 220. I seem to recall taking a crossroad thinking we were likely to find something closer to the highway. Even though we were confirmed horror/sci-fi geeks, we weren't really discussing anything strange on our drive. We were mostly thinking about grabbing dinner and finding a room. We expected to find a town or hotel and fast food rich area, and were stunned to now see nothing but woods and the occasional closed shop or house in the distance off the road. I haven't been back there in any recent years, but I imagine like everywhere it is more developed. But at the time, it was rural. We drove in one direction for about 15 minutes and found nothing open, so turned back around to double back past the exit and hope for the best. We finally spotted a shopping center with a gas station up ahead on the left. We pulled in and quickly saw that the entire place looked closed. It was empty. Almost. It was by this time, after 11 p.m., I believe closer to 11:30. Standing maybe 100 or so feet away, near what appeared to be a gas station storefront, under a light, were three children. There were two boys and one girl. They looked to be about 8 to 10 years old. They all looked similar, as if they were siblings. They were blonde, square-faced. I don't recall a specific eye color, but I did mentally note they were all in bathing suits. I remember thinking, even at that moment, it was weird for little kids to be coming back from swimming at that late hour. And if I recall, they did not look wet. We had stopped at a pump, and the kids were staring at us, and then they all began saying something. It became obvious the place was entirely closed for the night. It was early August. Our windows in the car were down. They were talking to us, but I distinctly remember I couldn't hear or make out what they were saying. We saw no adults around, just these three kids in bathing suits after 11 p.m. at night in an extremely rural, seemingly empty lot. My friend, who was driving my car, and I didn't say a word. We just stared. And after maybe half a minute or a minute of watching them, wordlessly he drove away. It was perhaps 2 minutes later, you know, neither of us had spoken, and I said, "Was that strange?" And he replied, "That was strange." I'm not sure if I thought they were more than wayward children in the moment, but the entire oddness of the situation was palpable, considering up until then we hadn't seen another car or person since leaving the highway. We drove about another 2 miles in the direction we had been headed and had seen nothing else that to our eyes looked like civilization. A very dense fog suddenly came over the area, and there had been no fog up until that point. We agreed to head back to the highway and try our luck at another exit. We spotted a parking lot for some kind of building and proceeded to attempt to turn around. I say attempt because, remember that fog? Well, it was so dense we didn't see the concrete wall that prevented cars from driving out of the lot and into a ditch that was on the edge of the property. We both screamed and shouted New Jersey expletives as the wall seemed to rise out of the fog in front of my car, which slammed into it, and proceeded to climb the wall and become stuck, front tires in the air, on this 3-foot concrete guardrail. We sat stunned, and my friend began apologizing profusely. Without exaggeration, at that moment, the fog began to evaporate, and we were stranded across the street from an old church building with what looked like a really ancient cemetery sprawling out from it. It quite literally looked about as Stephen King as you could get. All I said was, "You killed us! Those vampire kids are going to come suck us dry!" And strangely, we both just started laughing. We got out of the car, and there was no way we were getting this car off the divider. We sat for nearly 20 minutes hoping a car would come by and see us. Eyes kept glancing back to the cemetery, fully expecting to see a shadowy form creeping towards us. We did see one or two cars pass on the road, but no one stopped. Eventually, my friend took one for the team and decided he would very bravely walk the dark country lane past the old church and see if he could find any sign of the living. I sat, amused and mostly concerned my car was damaged and we would derail our trip. I don't think I really believe the undead were stalking the town, except for maybe a little. Shortly after he left, someone stopped. It was a nurse heading to the highway to her work at a local hospital. She was very concerned and said she would call someone when she got to work. Just after that, the local police pulled up, and once they ascertained I was not drunk, unlike our tow truck driver who would eventually arrive sometime later, and heard the story, they began laughing. They said they had spotted my friend walking to the local convenience store, if only we had driven another mile and a half and not turned around, and would go retrieve him and call the tow truck for us. They returned with him quickly and continued to have a good laugh at our expense, also indicating we weren't the first to hit that concrete barrier late at night. Soon they departed, and a tow truck driver, or more precisely an operator who had clearly just come from a local pub, and the operator, being driven in the truck by his 14 or so year old son, arrived and then took us to a local room above a bar, which the tavern owner rented to us for a small fee. I am glad I was that tired and the room was that dark and I couldn't see just how grimy the place was at night. The next morning we got the number for the local garage the car had been towed to, and fortunately there was no major damage. An hour or two and a couple of $100 later, we were back on the way. We did stop back at that gas station to gas up. We got breakfast sandwiches within and asked if anyone had been there around 11 o'clock the previous night as we tried to get gas and had thought we saw someone. The clerk said, to their knowledge, it was closed up and empty earlier than that. It was in the light of day, safely back on the highway and headed west. We compared notes and realized how strange our night before had been. I've thought a lot about that night. I've retold this story quite a few times. I've considered they may have been ghosts. A few locals have noted there are quarries in that area that many children have drowned in. But I could never get details. They didn't have black eyes. But would they have asked for a ride if we had stayed and tried to interact with them? It was a story that only comes out of grand road trips, particularly before the age of mobile phones and constant connectivity. If anyone has similar or adjacent stories from that area, I'd love to hear them, particularly stories of otherworldly children or legends that couldn't support the sighting. And if anyone remembers being a kid out wandering in a bathing suit that early August night in 1996 and seeing two city weirdos pulling up to where they were hanging out, I'd love to know that too.
The veil between the living and the dead is thinner than this commercial break. Let's get back to unraveling this dead letter.
Okay, there's a lot of things going on here that I think are really interesting. The first one is, and I know we're obviously, we're going to talk about BEK because that's what we do and we have our series and we, you know, Brian Bethel's a friend of ours and all that stuff. We know all that stuff. We're going to talk about that. But there's a couple things about this. First of all, Brian's story that took place for him, and for folks who don't know, listen to our series on Black-Eyed Children.
Yeah.
If you want to know more about that, Brian Bethel is credited with writing one of the first stories to hit the internet about that, and then it became creepypasta, blah, blah, blah,
yeah,
and so on and so forth. There's hours of us talking about that. But his story took place in Abilene, Texas, and it hit the internet in 1998. Now, according to John here, all of these events took place in 1996. So he doesn't, at the time anyway, have that framework in his mind of Black-Eyed Children. I will say, again, having had some time in Pennsylvania and live in it, and for anybody who has lived in and around a state with lots of rivers or recreational rivers, you see kids in swimsuits all the time and adults and random people walking down the street with inner tubes because they've accidentally rode 30 miles down a river from their car or whatever. Yeah. There's a lot
in
of
the
that
daytime.
Kind of stuff. Yes, in the daytime. These children, 11 p.m. in this parking lot by themselves. Of course, you know, one thing you think is like, oh, well, I sure hope their parents didn't forget to come get them and you guys just drove away because you got freaked out. But on the other hand, like the unintelligible talking and the bathing suits not being visibly wet. And then, of course, there's the vibe, which you got to trust your instincts when it comes to those vibes, especially when it's paranormal. And then we get into all the stuff with the fog and running up on the barrier and the cemeteries. And there's a lot going on here. And they've gotten off the beaten path for sure. And I think they, you know, they're kind of paying a price for it. Now, psychologically, I think it also put them into a frame of mind. They're tired. They're hungry. They don't really know where they are. They've not seen country like this before.
Yeah. Listen, the one grounding fact here is that it's 11:30 at night and there are kids. So you start with that. Is that, okay, that's very unusual. Now, when I was growing up in a suburban setting, it's common in the summer we'd be running around until about 9, you know, after dinner, you're outside. And, you know, when the street light comes on, that's when you're supposed to go inside. And it's funny, over the local television, they'd always run this thing. It's like, it's 10 p.m. Do you know where your children are? Because some folks aren't that buttoned up, let's say, and they don't know. And the kids are still running around and smashing pumpkins, doing things that kids that aren't very well monitored are doing.
Yes.
But this sounds different. This isn't like the ruffian kids like Nelson from The Simpsons or whatever, just out, you know, making up their own rules. The setup's a little bit different than this. And so this is unusual. And we're starting there at that fact is that there's no one else around. They wouldn't be swimming at night.
No, definitely not. Definitely not.
Yeah.
So dangerous. And they would be scared. I would think the kids would be scared. I mean, sure, there's some kids that are not afraid of anything, but I can't imagine these three kids would be swimming in the dark in a river at 11 p.m. or whatever swimming hole is nearby. I just can't see it. Not this young. Not this young.
If they were kids.
Yeah.
And if they were in trouble, wouldn't they be waving them down like, hey, mister, you know, they're talking, they're saying something.
Right.
Now, all these factors, I'm going to compare to another story, but I'm going to let you lay your groundwork first as to what you think might be happening or some details that jumped out at you as noticeable or remarkable.
There's a couple of things that are interesting. I mean, this is a movie waiting to be made, honestly. It's
Children of the Parking Lot.
One thing that I thought about here is one of the things we brought up on the show in the past is Gavin De Becker's book, The Gift of Fear.
Oh, yeah.
Which between him and, I mean, these are older concepts now in literary circles, but The Gift of Fear, as well as Malcolm Gladwell's books and that sort of thing. It's just this idea of trusting your gut and your instinct and what you're seeing. But the other thing that Gavin De Becker talks about in that book, and that's a personal protection angle on how to, you know, keep yourself safe, especially in urban environments, or, you know, to understand when you might be in danger. One of the things that I remember that he points out in that book that I thought was really fascinating is that frequently when somebody snaps or commits a crime, and I've seen this ever since then, whenever I'm watching like true crime stuff with my wife, because she watches a lot of that stuff, is that a lot of times the people, especially if there's workplace violence, everybody in the workplace is joking about the thing that winds up happening. And it's like, you know, Charlie, I bet tomorrow Charlie comes in here and shoots this place up, you know, and then sure enough, a couple weeks later, Charlie comes in and shoots the place up. I think about that when I think about John here making his joke about vampire kids. It's like the joke that you're doing, that joke is your mind. There's danger here. And I'm joking. Those were vampire kids. And it's like,
well, in a form, not the Bela Lugosi, the Hunger, the sexy type vampires, or even, or just Children of the Corn type thing.
Yeah.
So that thing with kids, it's like they're not behaving as you would expect them to in a scenario that you would expect to find them in. And that's unsettling.
Right.
It's like, what are you doing out here? And so their swimsuits aren't wet. The gas station seems abandoned. If they had been left behind, would they be waving down people for help? You would think so, or at least walking home towards the highway or along the highway. That's what we would have done.
Right.
And if they're out by themselves, why would they have bikes? We always had bikes. Or maybe it was close enough to walk to, but where are they going?
Yeah.
All of that is unsettling, even under normal circumstances. If it were broad daylight.
I wish we had a more precise geographic location on this.
Right.
Because like I was looking all around and I'm like trying to figure out where it is. I mean, I think it's near Lock Haven, Pennsylvania, but that's not super rural. So they had to have been outside of that. I mean, it's a small town, but it's not as small and remote as what they're talking about here.
Yeah. So, I mean, like I said, you're thinking of all these other ideas, but we are starting with, you know, we're trying to cover the mundane aspects. It's like, okay, that's possible. Like I said, we did have Nelson Muntz type kids at my school growing up, but that's, again, that was another era. You'd have to tell me, being the father of a Gen Alpha, what's the Gen now status? Alpha, beta, I don't know.
Oh, you're asking, I don't know. I got a Gen Z kid and I stopped checking after that.
So the idea though is that, you know, there were different rules for different times. Back in the 90s there, it's maybe more likely that kids are out by themselves running around, depending on the area. Okay, now farm kids I know out in the rural sticks, they're more trusted to run off and do stuff by themselves. But again, this is not out in rural boondocks farm country where there's less of a likelihood of stranger danger, because in these small towns, everybody knows each other. So they watch out for each other's kids. So they're afforded more responsibilities on their own. But this seems more rural / suburban. There's no one around, but it's a very eerie setting that's described to us. I'm going to ask you, what do you think's going on here? And then I'm going to tell you two or three possibilities I'm thinking of.
I don't know. See, you know, for me, the fact that we don't have the confirmation of black eyes, for example, tells me to be careful about lumping it in into the wrong category just because it has common ground with things in that category. You know, it's something I've learned from our show. It goes both ways. You know, it's like, and I always talk about Micah Hanks talking, the episode he did, The Search for Man Like Monsters in History. looking for Bigfoot or ideas of Bigfoot across many cultures and civilizations around the world throughout time and human history, and realizing that everyone's using different language because they don't have the same words for the things they're encountering, but that if you peel away some of those rules, you suddenly realize that all these things are in one category. So on that, in that way, maybe this does fit, and maybe the black-eyed part of black-eyed kids, maybe these kids were black-eyed and we couldn't tell, or maybe they weren't, and this is a different phenomenon. These could just be good old-fashioned, plain old, ordinary ghosts.
Well, that is one of my categories. Yeah, like I said, if for whatever reason, and no knock on this community, but if you're that unminding of your children and they're off swimming in the quarries, and as our reader said, now you look this up, but there was at least stories of kids drowning in the quarries, the swimming holes around there.
Right. Yes, there absolutely are.
So that's one possibility. I'm going to write this down. Number one,
yes.
Ghosts. Because I think when we have people send these stories, and yes, we're going to do it anyway. We take liberties, but they want to know, what do you think this is? What do you think is going on here? Because I have no clue. And so we do our best. Again,
right.
I can't tell you, but what I can do is point to other instances of other people's stories and anecdotes where there might be similarities. And I will address your point here of the eyes. And what are we looking at? Well, ghosts or a form of them. We just got done talking about this in a DLO about the crossover, this ever-expanding Venn diagram of beings and what space they occupy. And it is much more of a, everything is connected. Spooky action at a distance, spooky action up close, spooky action in a abandoned gas station. Or
yeah.
What's going on here? And I think I'd mentioned the fact that at least with the Sam the Sandown Clown and kids and their understanding of what it is, I made note of the fact when we did the story, you know, obviously young kids know what robots are, especially we talked about toy robots. And there's a lot of toys that do that or have the speak and say and the, you know, the little microphone that's attached. All these things that may have been a screen memory or some kind of screen image presented to these kids. They didn't ask if he was a spaceman or a robot, as I said in the past episode. They asked him if he was a ghost.
Right.
And I love right. Sam's answer because he said, well, sort of. So what is he suggesting, if that's accurate in his response? I occupy a space that is somewhere in another realm than you folks. I can appear and disappear. I'm not really from here, but I'm a visitor, or I've kind of faded in for a while. And I can do these wonderful things, like have a berry travel inside my ear and out my nose and into my mouth, whatever he can do. But he's also mechanical. Like he just occupies a different space, maybe like these kids did or do. And as you were mentioning before, what I'll say in this anecdote, this is the story that I'm going to reference here because I think there are some similarities, is that we like to think and group things because that's how we make sense of them. It's like, well, it can't be this because it didn't do that. And it can't be this type of creature because it didn't say this and it didn't look like this. And so
right.
we got to rule that out. It's like, well, what are you doing? You're just putting rules in a bunch of way out there stuff anywhere. Anyway, that we have no ideas about other than what we get from experience and experiencers. And so this paranormal investigator, whose story I'm going to relay here in a second, did the same thing. It's like, well, I don't know if I'd categorize my encounter as black-eyed kids because they didn't do this. And that's what all the stories seem to suggest. Well, how do we know? Are they one form of this? Is there a spiritual component to this where there's a difference between the physical corporeal manifestation of a spirit as a black-eyed kid, and that's what you're seeing, but they're as physical as anything else. It'd be funny if like some other kid punched it in the stomach and it doubled over. It's like, how do you like that? Not that that's
right.
funny, but just the fact that they are physical, spiritual beings in a physical bag, which is what Bob Monroe said about us. We are spiritual beings having a physical experience, not the other way around. And so that's the
right.
manifestation that they have. And they have these real world needs. Like, is it food time? Let us in so we can eat the food. I need to use your telephone. It's like, why? Or I need to use your telegraph. It's like, why are you even asking other than that's a ploy for something else? And so the fact that the kids were talking to them too, but not like yelling or screaming like, hey, mister, we need help. Or could you call our parents for us or something? They seem to be talking, but not totally audibly. And so, again, I think it's a mistake to try and nail this down into what this was, but we can look at other cases and see, okay, what things were similar? Yes, they could appear as ghosts. They weren't close to them, so they weren't up close. But as we know, people who report ghosts often said, they're as real and solid looking as anything else. They were just gone, where they were a reflection, but they were making noise too, right? They heard them talking to them. So that's interesting. Another area is, are they hybrid alien kids? And I know that gets a lot of eye rolls, but we're hearing more and more about this. Now, all these things are mentioned in the book I'm going to reference from, David Weatherly's Strange Intruders. What a great book. I mean, just so much creepy, good fun.
We have an episode on it of our main show. David's been on our show. He's an amazing author, really great compiler of stories. Look for his books anywhere you get books. And definitely look for our David Weatherly episodes on our main show, by the way.
If nothing else, like you're trying to figure out what this is, it's a great compendium of all these freaky cases of running into strange beings. And, you know, David will say himself, he's like, well, I don't know what they are, but like you can make your own conclusions. And if you experience some of this, maybe it gives you some answers or insight into something similar, or to at least know that you're not alone in these kinds of experiences. This one story I'm pretty sure I talked about in past episodes, but just briefly in passing, which is why we had trouble finding it in our transcripts of past episodes. But I was actually able to find it in the Kindle version of David's book, Strange Intruders. And this one always stuck with me just because of the scenario and the cinematic nature of the encounter, but also some things like you were saying, it's like, well, they didn't do this. So I don't know if I'd categorize it as that kind of experience or being. And this story is at least, I think, in page 135 of the Kindle version, at least.
Of the Kindle edition.
David is talking about a psychic and paranormal investigator, lives on the West Coast, named Christina George. And this is her story. And I'm just going to like hit some highlights here because it's a good creepy story. And I think it's a good companion or something complimentary to the story tonight from John. So it starts off, David saying, you know, like many people in the field, she's encountered some strange things while investigating haunted sites and paranormal cases, but nothing prepared her for this encounter with what are possibly black-eyed people. So this story, I think if you could find her, again, Christina George says, originally posted on her website titled Black Eyed Kids Encounter, or is it? And it's reprinted from, with her permission. This happens in the summer of 2012. With her and a few of her paranormal group friends, they went to go check out an abduction site in Redding, California area. It's known as a hotspot for UFOs. And so after all this, they finish their investigation. They get home later that day. She decides to go to the store with her roommate. And so she explains more about her roommate. Has been friends with him for over 20 years. Private guy, likes his privacy. Their home is the end of a dead-end road that's backed up to a green belt. So it's a suburban area they know very well. There's a hill and a creek just down below outside the door. They do not, as roommates, answer their door to unknown or unannounced visitors. And if he does answer it, he doesn't like that. He's going to tell you he doesn't want you there. So I think he's a nice guy, but just like his privacy, doesn't like solicitors. He doesn't like it when people are around the house and there's no reason for them to be on their property. And she says, so this is where the story gets weird. So they're driving back to their home, and out on the grass in front of the house were three people, an older woman who, as she describes in her passage here, was maybe about 45, brown eyes, has long hippie-like made dress that was all wrinkled, and some different colored sandals, one of them being Gary Gygax's sandal. I made that. I'm just seeing if you're paying attention. That's not true.
Okay, nice anyway, callback.
But sandals, yeah, well done. Different colored sandals. Pay attention. That's a clue. Not matching sandals. Then the next person out on the lawn, there was a little African-American girl, about 10 years old. Her hair was not combed. She had mismatched shorts, okay, and a t-shirt, also wrinkled, but she was very pale and almost looked sick and skinny and had a very dry and ashy appearance. And the third was a young boy, about 10 years of age, with very blonde, bowl-cut hair with bangs, straight across, and again, mismatched shorts and a shirt. But what really stood out was his pale white skin and piercing blue eyes. So as they pull up now to their garage after coming home from their investigation, the roommate says, who the hell are these people? And, you know, she looks but has no idea who they are. And they know everybody in their subdivision. Okay. So again, this is giving me the same kind of suburban slash wooded area, though, vibe as New Jersey, even though this is the West Coast, right in California.
Right.
She goes, I know just about everyone there. I've never seen them. They're standing on our grass as if they were waiting for us. My roommate says, I'll be right back. I'm going to find out why they're here and what they're looking for. And she agrees. And then she watches from the car as he walks over and starts talking to them. And this is maybe a good reason why John and his traveling buddy did not talk to these kids directly. She's watching as he has his hand on his hips and then drops them down to his side, then turns around and walks back with no expression on his face, gets in the car, turns it back on, pulls the car into the garage and closes the door. And she asks, well, who were they? What do they want? And he replies in a very monotone voice, they are looking for some feral kittens. And she finds this very strange because there's no kittens around anywhere in the area and no flyers posted. And what they found even more strange was the fact that he was okay with that answer. And, you know, it's very uncharacteristic of him. These kids had an effect on him. And she says, well, why didn't you tell them to leave? In which he replied, it's okay. Don't worry about it. And then he gets out of the car, goes in the house, and doesn't say anything else. So there's also a moment of that blankness where you're processing something, but it sounds like he was affected.
Right. Which is similar to what John and his friend and the story, like, they just drive away without even talking.
Which happens a lot in UFO sightings as well. Like your brain's like, what just happened? What did we see? In this case, it might be more. Yeah. I think in Christina's story, it might be more than that. He was physically and psychically and mentally affected. So then she goes into the house on the main floor. And she goes upstairs, but she had a really weird feeling. She couldn't just shake about what just happened. So she goes back downstairs to the main floor and to the window she has next to the door. She peeks through the blinds just to see if they're really looking for kittens. She looks through the blinds and she sees the woman standing on the side of the hill outside with one child on each side of her. They're holding hands. And it was as if they could sense she was looking at them. And she says, quote, they all three turned their heads and bodies around in perfect sync and looked dead at me. Continuing on. Now, if that wasn't scary enough, I look and see that they all three now have completely black eyes with no whites visible at all. I remember it made their eyes look so big and scary. I was so terrified. I jumped away from the blinds, hitting the back of my head on the door handle, and she runs out of there. So keep that in mind. The eyes had changed from what they were. And then she looked again, maybe like, okay, maybe I just saw something, you know, maybe I was imagining that. And she screams for the roommate and he's not there. She's banging on his door. He's not answering. She's yelling his name. And it sounds like he just went and took a shower. He had just taken one. So why is she taking another one? She runs back upstairs, not knowing what to do, how to calm herself down. She finally comes down to get the courage to go back to the blinds to look through them. And she says, I now see that they have moved. They are near a tree in a circle holding hands. They are swaying back and forth, and I can hear them saying what sounded almost like a chant. I hear and see them, and at that moment, again, they all turn in unison and look directly at me. Again, seeing a closer look at them, and they still have completely black eyes with no whites visible. Once again, I get this overwhelming feeling of fear come over me. She runs downstairs again. She bangs on the roommate's door. No response. And she doesn't know what to do. She's freaking out. And she says, tells herself, come on, Christina, you're a paranormal investigator. People come to you because of stuff like this, and you're never afraid. And she snaps herself out of it. And then she somehow manages to open the door, and she yanks the door open, and she walks outside. And, you know, with some now courage mustered, she says, can I help you with something? And they look over at her. They drop their hands, and the woman looks at her and says, no, we're done. And she was confused for a moment, says, well, did you find the kittens? But they said nothing, and they walked off. She walks back into the house with the roommate again, and she yells at him, like, come over here. Like, these people had black eyes. They were holding hands, chanting. They knew I was looking at them from inside the house and everything else. And then he asked her, you know, where they were. And I said, come on, they just walked away. We ran outside. They're gone. She even gets in the car, drives around the neighborhood looking for them. Nowhere to be found. She found no one. And she said it troubled her for a very long time. So then she talks to her paranormal investigation team. And they were all reporting their own experiences of some paranormal activity since returning from that client's house. So it turns into an investigation at a haunted house connected to a black-eyed kid sighting.
Hitchhikers.
Something. Hitchhikers. Something is connected to that.
No, it's hitchhikers. It's, I mean, straight like a Skinwalker yeah. Ranch. It's like the whole idea of you involve an investigation and things something is following everybody right. home. And interacting with people yeah. in different ways, but hers was the most intense, which coming back to John and his story and the hitchhiker concept, which is a recently emerging concept for us. I mean, the past couple of years, we've been reading about right. it, learning about it, primarily originally as it related to Skinwalker Ranch and observations that George Knapp and Lakatsky and Colm Kelleher made. So then the question is, when you look at John's situation, like, could they have stumbled across something or tripped into something that somehow drew these beings to them or to their right. environment? And that then led them to get into this scenario with them, which also later led to, you know, an actual minor car.
Yeah. Problem, okay. Car I got to think about, yeah, I got to think about the fog, but just to wrap this up, because yeah. here's to that point, yeah. like I said, it was specific to what you're talking about when you try to label this with what you know. Later, of course, you're right. like, what more perfect scenario than this happening to a paranormal investigator? Which is what she said. So she's right. got a team of people. They found out they were all reporting their own experiences, but none of them were as intense as hers. So then she contacts right. a good friend of hers, Anthony Sanchez, and she tells him about what just happened. And then he said quickly that he thought that she had an encounter with what is called black-eyed children. And Christina says, I was initially intrigued and started doing some research, but quickly felt that maybe this wasn't what I experienced because of the differences in other reportings and mine. First, they did not knock on my door and ask to come in. Second, I saw the color of their eyes, which were originally brown and little boy had blue, and then they changed. And third, I couldn't find any reportings of them holding hands or chanting. She says, quote, I did feel a little defeated, but knew nonetheless what I had experienced that day was real. But now I needed to figure out what this is and what it means. So the things that stand out to me from this story is that are also the most chilling, the holding hands, the chanting, the hippie lady, just unfettered. But they're chanting. And the fact that they're kind of singing this sing-songy kind of thing, but the chanting reminds me of the words spoken by the children that were unintelligible. And then she says, can I help you? And she says, no, we're done. What were they done with? What are you doing? Like, what was right. it? I mean, is it a spell? Were they chanting a spell? Is it something frequency-based, vibrational, that they were trying to affect? They obviously had an effect on her roommate. I mean, he was catatonic almost, you know, just freaked out and mind zapped.
Yeah.
And she was terrified, but maybe coming at it from a different place. So, you know, like he said, it is a little bit also of these are not the droids you're looking for. Like, no, it's fine. Don't worry about it. They're looking for kittens. They had a little bit of a mind effect on him, at least. So I want to know, yeah, what are they doing? So, but my point being is that you think like, well, they're not black-eyed kids because the eyes weren't black the whole time. It's like, well, they turn black. Okay, that's good enough for me. that's not natural. This is not a normal thing. Now, I believe John and his road trip mate were too far away to get a clear assessment, but something was happening there where it just wasn't right. That whole thing was wrong. And then you get to the part where there's a fog. Now, does that remind you of a past interview we did with friends of ours?
When I think about mysterious fogs, I think about, well, we recently talked about the fog that ate the deer, roadkill off the fence.
Boy, that's the worst child children's book ever.
Yes, and then the fog in Point Pleasant that I think you saw or drove through
yourself.
That's
right. I was going to mention that, and I'm surprised you remember that.
Yeah, I remember that fog, and I remember other fogs in general, but no, I can't place what – I don't think I'm placing exactly which
– What I'm thinking of right that's connected to another strange experience and a bit of a mini road trip was Susan Lambert Haddam, Richard Haddam's wife, and her good friend Dan Povenmire. While they were driving to San Diego, okay, they were driving down from LA to San Diego. They'd already had their other strange missing time experience, their time slip.
This is from episode 149 of Astonishing Legends, folks. It's called Dan, Susan, Micah Hanks, and Missing Time. It's funny you would bring this up right now because Micah was on that show, and Micah also wrote the foreword for David Weatherly's book that we just read
It's all connected.
But again, folks, look for David Weatherly's book. It's called Strange Intruders. Go find it wherever you can find books. It's an excellent read.
Yeah, it's another great story. Now, Dan and Susan, as they were driving, the only thing strange was seeing strange sights, which we wonder were some kind of screen memory from the phenomenon. Not to pinpoint it, but again, this is what I'm hesitant to do. Like, oh, you had a UFO experience. Oh, you had a missing time slip experience. I don't know. This is just something unusual, out of the ordinary happened. But like they both saw something strange. I think I think at the time Dan said, well, didn't you see that VW microbus on its roof on fire? She goes, no, I didn't see that. But did you see the tanks crossing the road? Well, I didn't see that. Yeah. Things you think they both would have seen and remembered because they were dramatic. Now, I don't know what happened to them. I don't think they did either, but it seems quite unusual. Much as this case, it's like, it's not that out of the ordinary. They didn't have the kids come up. They didn't touch them and they passed out. You know, like there's nothing that's physically or directly that out of this world, but it's weird. And that seems unnatural. So what are these things? Well, again, you got the three categories now. So you got ghosts. You have something that is probably partially connected to that being a form of black-eyed kid. I'm not saying they were BEKs, but they were manifestations of some other spiritual or ethereal kind of being that was just there. Three, some kind of alien human hybrid kids. Another story was a woman who was at a gas station, another gas station. Be careful at gas stations, folks. Strange things can walk up to you. Where the woman's, I think it was the middle of the day. This is also in David Weatherly's book. A young girl, with the blonde hair, the bowl cut, with the bangs, very large blue eyes, comes up to this woman and says, I'm your child or something. And she knew it was a hybrid alien child. Just by herself, no parents around, just walks up and then walks off and is not to be seen again. Not vanishing into thin air before your eyes, but just like you turn around, she's gone. Another story where, is it something like that? Well, I don't know, possibly, but out of the two, or the fourth thing is that you just have unattended kids and very, very irresponsible parents.
Right.
And is that, out of those three, like if you've done this as long as we have and has read as much, which of those sounds the most plausible or the most unlikely? Yeah. And it's like, I guess the most mundane is this kid's out wandering by themselves in swimwear from a day's swim and nobody's checking on them. That's certainly possible. But just the feeling you get and the words spoken and just the kind of the scenario. And then you have the fog and all the other things. And it just, it's a very odd experience. So I'm not sure what type of beings they were, but I would bet that if they got up close to them, it may have been a strange and unwanted intrusion.
Man, I think you're summing this up really kind of perfectly. And
thank you for the first time. And it's not my usual rambling diatribe to nowhere on a road.
We're on the road to nowhere. What I'm saying is, like, I enjoyed the David Weatherly connection, and I had forgotten about that story in that book, which is really fascinating. Here's another thing. My particular version, my personal copy of Google Earth, has pins, not for every story we've talked about, but for a lot of them, a lot of different things, that especially unique places. And what's interesting is that about 30 miles roughly from where this dead letter takes place, John's story, wherever, and we don't know exactly where they were because they don't really seem to know, but they know they were near Lock Haven maybe. That's only about 25 or 30 miles from where a guest of our show, it was episode 236 called Your True Stories, Volume 1. We posted this in late June of 2022. Almost exactly 4 years ago to the day as we're recording this. We record some of these early. But in that show, our guest Tom Delaney came on. He was a hunter and gone hunting with a friend and came across in a very rural and remote area a super, super unusual structure.
Yes.
Way out in the woods that he and we all described as, for lack of a better term or label, a Bigfoot nest. a giant structure made of logs that were too hard for a single human to put together in this very remote area. And the structure was very unusual in shape and size.
The other thing I remember, he had extreme fear because, look, if I was a kid, I would run in there, that opening, because I would guess that some other human or kids built this because I grew up in the era of tree forts and ground forts and field forts. And we had our own little, and like, I would just be interested. But he said, like, he was too deathly afraid to even go near the entrance of this thing.
Here's some weird thing. I mean, Bigfoot, whatever, and black-eyed kids, when, man, do they know each other? I don't know. But this, where this happened and where that happened, they're not very far apart. So I'll just tell you that for nothing. Because we know exactly where Tom experienced what he didn't. He asked us not to put it out there in the public, but we know where it was. And it was not far from this place. He did indicate he was in central PA, which is exactly what we're talking about, the Pennsylvania wilds and all the spookiness there. And there's a lot of folklore there. We came across folklorists who have been saving up stories from there of things like the water witch, who was like this creature that comes out of the lake and tells you your fortune, or all of these stories about deaths and quarries and swimming and you know, maybe in the Susquehanna as well. There's a lot of possibilities there for what would be the impetus to create these beings or have them intersect with our friends and also with Christina in the story. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I found a website where she's still talking about black-eyed kids. So she's definitely still out there on this. But it's very spooky and it's very creepy. And it begins to feel like, oh, well, let's connect it back to deaths in the quarries or even to this geographical area that people are in. But I think it's very telling that what Christina said about coming off of an investigation, which obviously these guys weren't doing, they're going to a gaming convention, tabletop gaming convention. So they're not finishing up a spooky paranormal investigation, but it does remind you, like Christina's story from Weatherly's book, maybe the geography and even the time and place have nothing to do with any of these kinds of things. Maybe it's just all about you, the person. And these things are coming for you, and the time and place, maybe they're more effective or present themselves in that way because that's their sweet spot in terms of appearance. But maybe it had nothing to do with the fact that they looked like kids, or that they were in swimsuits, that they were in the Pennsylvania wilds. Maybe they were just spiritually drawn to interact with John and his friend.
To clarify earlier, and I may have given the impression that they were investigating a haunted house.
Yeah.
But what she says is that was in the summer of 2012. Myself and a few members of my paranormal group had went up to see a client reporting being abducted, having an implant, and then also experiencing paranormal activity.
Shut the front door.
So.
All right. So that's an additional context that needed to be added, I guess. Yeah.
Well, okay. But all does it? This is what I'm saying. If there's still a... You've seen us.
I'm getting creeped out.
And
man.
Now we've it's seen a, you.
I just for people to know, we record these all different times a day. But for right now, for me, it's 12:40 in the morning.
Right.
I'm in kind of a rural area, and I'm about ready to wrap this episode up.
Hey, you're in a very lovely area with a community pool and whatnot. But
trust me, it can be pretty spooky here.
Right. So here's I had just kind of skimmed over thinking it was a general paranormal investigation, which I mean, it kind of is.
But it's a Terry Lovelace story.
What, this?
The common ground here is a little too weird for me because, you know, we were talking about Terry Lovelace and the intersection between black-eyed kids and abduction. And then his experience was at a place called the Devil's Den in Arkansas. These guys are at a place in Pennsylvania called the Demon's Den. And then there's a connection back to Christina George and her experience, which you rightly pulled out of David Weatherly's book. And that is an offshoot of them checking in on somebody who had an abduction case related to them, which is very similar to what happened to Terry Lovelace, which then begs the question, John, if you're listening, if something more happened that you're not remembering.
Yeah, you know, and thinking about this more, that there may be more to it that you don't remember. But here's my point, because this is now, of course, with all the talk of disclosure and even just listen to our friend Rob Christofferson being interviewed by our other friend, Richard Haddam, whose wife also experienced the fog. And just now it's like, I think Rich asked him, like, are you one of those disclosure guys? So now there's a type of person in this genre that's a disclosure person or disclosure guy or gal.
Right, right.
It's like, I don't want to label anyone, but one of the more controversial topics or concepts that's come up with this is now very divisive, is that with the disclosure and the UFO scenario and the narratives, is there a religious, spiritual component to this where we wanted to keep those separate before? Ghosts don't interact with UFOs and Bigfoot doesn't interact with any of them. And now there's always been talk of that. And it's like, well, that's a fascinating concept because whatever these portals are or these hotspots that happen, there's a lot of different types of activity that have been documented and overlaid. And you could see like, well, people see UFOs in the spot. Also, they see Bigfoots in the spot. Also, they see ghosts in the spot or dog men or goat men, whatever kind of man you got. So you have all these stories that are seeming to overlap. Why is that happening? Is there a connection? But that's a very controversial take because, of course, now it's like with the, you know, the big beef is that, well, there's some people at the Pentagon, the DOD, and all these other places that are super religious, and they believe that UFOs are connected to demonic activity, that there's just a cover, it's all a screen memory of sorts, and what you're really dealing with is a spiritual demonic force that is somehow fooling you. Well, that's the one end of the spectrum. The other is that, no, let's not bring religion and spirituality into this. This is still other beings that are just really good at science, and they've had a lot of years to practice, much more than us. And that's what's happening here. It's much more scientific, and it's not spiritual at all. And then you start to see a hybrid of that too, pun intended, is that you're seeing some instances where there seems to be some kind of spiritual activity that is connected to some of this. So yeah, as she says, she and her few members of her paranormal group, they went up to see this client in what seems to be a UFO abduction case with a possible implant. And they spend the whole day going through medical paperwork and they get electronic readings and pictures. And then they all finished up. They all seem to have some kind of activity, but hers seems to be the most dramatic or intense. So that's what the setup is. But is this totally unconnected and unrelated to anything that's spiritual, or black-eyed kids part of that, where they're beings with some kind of bad mojo vibration, but it's not demonic, it's something else? Well, I think you'll end up in trouble and with egg on your face if you try to define this, because that's how humans operate. We want to get a handle on this. And so all the comments you read on these various posts, like, that's so stupid. It's not that, it's this. It's like, okay, how do you know? Well, it doesn't make sense to me. Like, okay, noted. But no one, except for the very insiders on this, I think have a more informed perspective. But even then, these insiders, this shadow government or whatever you want to call it, they might be being fooled. We don't have the upper hand here in all of this. We're not the apex predator in the UFO, ghost, and cryptid food pyramid. We're at the bottom or even somewhere in the middle, but we're not at the top.
Well, John, we want to thank you so much for sending your story in. We hope we didn't freak you out too much. I know we freaked me out. This was a good one. Mission accomplished. It was fun. It was fun talking about this. We'd love to know if you have any follow-ups or additional information relating to it. And we hope that you're not seeing those kids or anyone even remotely like them ever again. Thank you so much for sending your letter into the Astonishing Dead Letter office.
The Astonishing Dead Letter Office is hosted by Scott Philbrook and Forrest Burgess and is executive produced by Tess Feifel. The show is edited and mixed by Sarah Voorhees-Wendell at VW Sound. The theme is based on the Astonishing Legends theme by Judson Crane at Founder Music, arranged by Alan Caricia, who composes all the other music in the show. Tommy Beaver Design created the logo. The announcer is John Bolton. That's me. Stories are lightly edited for length, content, and readability, but otherwise presented as they're sent to us. We're always looking for more dead letters, so if you have a story of your own you'd like to share, email it to deadletteroffice@astonishinglegends.com. Please include how you would like to be credited. First name only, first name last initial, anonymous, a pseudonym. Let us know. Due to the number of emails coming in, we often cannot respond, but we do read them all. No part of the show may be reproduced anywhere without permission. Copyright Astonishing Legends Productions.